Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second of this year's Humanitas lectures on media. For those who were not at yesterday's lecture, I should explain that every year we have a Humanitas professor in media who comes to Cambridge to give a number of lectures and participate in a symposium. This scheme is made possible by the generosity of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and I'd like to register our thanks to them for making it possible. In Cambridge, the Humanitas professors are administered and based in CRASH, the Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. And I'd also like to thank the staff of that centre for all the work they do in order to make these events happen. In choosing the Humanitas professors, our policy has been to alternate between practitioners and academic or other commentators on media. So, for example, in recent years, we have had Professor Manuel Castells, who is, I guess, the leading scholar on cyberspace and communications, and Dr. Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google. This year's professor is, by any standards, a very prominent practitioner. He's Alistair Campbell, who was for many years Tony Blair's press secretary, and later director of communications at the heart of the government in 10 Downing Street. He is widely and properly credited with transforming the way in which governments in the UK communicate. He is also a Cambridge alumnus. He read Modern Languages here some time ago. In his lecture yesterday, he talked about the importance of journalism in an open society, as well as about the difficulties of practicing it in our newish networked environment. Until this morning, I had a fair idea of what he was going to talk about in today's lecture, but I know that he has been revising it in the light of developments this morning, and so we wait on tenterhooks to find out what he's going to say, which is a good reason for me to stop now and let him get on with it. He will speak for about 45 minutes, after which we will have questions and answers. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Alistair Campbell to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I liked the some time ago. I think I did my last exam here on the day that Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. Yeah. I was so busy, I didn't vote. But there we go. Should have got in anyway. Now, those of you who were... Hands up, first of all, who was here yesterday? Oh my God, quite a lot of you. You will know... Somebody's left some chewing gum on this bottle. God. Chewing gum should be banned in all places, but especially universities. I said that when I do these events, I always... My publisher follows me around with my books, and they'll be somewhere here. I haven't seen them yet, but they'll be somewhere here, and I'll do a signing at the end. But I always give a free book, either to a question I've never been asked before, or to what I consider to be the best question. Okay? Now, the winner yesterday... Is the winner here from yesterday? The question was, where do you shop? Now, actually, the reason I thought that was quite a good question was because it picked up on something that I'd said about never having been in a supermarket apart from to do a book signing. It wasn't where do you shop, it's who does your shopping, I beg your pardon. So, but actually, John Thompson was saying, and I think he's right, that the best question actually probably was this one. It was the young lady, I don't know if she's here or not, but she said, if you had still been a journalist in 2003, how would you have covered the Iraq war? And I thought that actually, not least because it's made me think quite a lot during the day about how crap my answer was, I think that probably was the best question. So if that person is here, so far you're winning, okay? But when we get onto the Q&A, others can... But please remember, I do a lot of talks, and therefore I do get asked the same questions a lot. So it is nice when you get questions that you haven't had before. I just throw that out there. Now, onto the substance, as it were. A few years ago, I was at a conference in Italy with Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. And I was surprised how much he and I agreed about the modern media. But what struck me most was his description that Watergate was what he called one of the greatest stories of all time, which it was, but, he added, a disaster for journalism. Now, as the Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman film showed, Woodward and Bernstein were utterly obsessive about facts, determined to go that extra distance to check them. There are reporters today for whom an investigation means two phone calls rather than one, or the dubious and illegal practices of which we've heard so much. Watergate was the best of journalism because it slowly, systematically uncovered a terrible truth that the most powerful man in the world wanted hidden. So why was it, in Carl Bernstein's own word, a disaster for journalism? Because just as kids wished to emulate sports stars, so from then on, journalists felt that the only real story is one that brings people down, the mightier, the better. Watergate's hold over the journalistic psyche is such that any scandal must have a gate. At least with Tory Chief Whip Andrew Mitchell, there is a real gate involved. The Downing Street gates at which the altercation took place, which is why, in my view, it should not have been called Plebgate, but Plebgate-gate. We had many, many gates. Does anybody remember Drapergate, or Lidlgate, or Lobbygate? Cheriegate, you might remember. That was about flats that didn't actually have a gate. Camillagate, that was about Prince Charles's phone calls. Saxgate, that was the one that Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross had to climb over. And Bigotgate, that was about Gordon Brown and a microphone. Now, great journalism requires time. Woodward and Bernstein were given time. Harry Evans, when he was editor of the Sunday Times, they had a team of reporters working for 8 months before exposing the establishment cover-up of Kim Philby's spy ring. There are few editors today who would allow anyone 8 months on a story. There is too much space to fill, as I said yesterday, less time, fewer people. Around the time of the Leveson inquiry, Harry Evans' thalidomide investigation and Bernstein's Watergate came up again and again as the kind of stories the press said that a new regulatory system would thwart. It's not true, because of the obvious public interest in both, but it's also actually a reminder of how few great stories the recent generation of self-styled seekers after truth have uncovered during the Murdoch-Dacre years. Today's newspapers lack both the patience and the investment. The gate has to be erected too quickly. Ironically, the one that bucked the trend was The Guardian's investigation of phone hacking, despite the desire of media, police, and politics for it to go away. In preparing for this, I had a quick look through recent UK Scoop of the Year awards. What were they? MPs' expenses? Yes, that was a genuinely big story. People went to jail on the back of it, and the system changed. Cricket corruption, match fixing, that was also incredibly important. Last year's winner was a series in the Times on tax avoidance, not focused on various media moguls. But also on the list, David Beckham's affair, John Prescott's affair, Sven and Ulrika, in which I played a minor part as I introduced them, true story, and phone hacking possibly played a part too. Yet, when the press were defending their freedoms from the modest changes proposed by Leveson, following an inquiry established by the democratically elected Prime Minister, after revelations which disgusted the public, leading to proposals overwhelmingly backed by public and MPs for a system in which once it was established, politicians would have no say whatsoever, they compared it to Zimbabwe, Iran, China, North Korea, not just Putin's Russia, but Stalin's Russia. It is the kind of absurd, self-serving bilge that would not have survived a moment's analysis had any other industry put something like it forward. The politicians have actually bent over backwards to accommodate what genuine concerns can be found amid press propaganda and, dare I say, press spin. And have we not seen how handy it is to have the papers on side when you're running a campaign. Have we not also seen, and this is my first reason for optimism about the future, that the public have seen through it all? The press has rightly been in the forefront of campaigns for regulation of banks, pension funds, MPs, doctors, lawyers, on and we go through virtually every walk of life. Only newspapers, it seems, despite trust ratings lower than any of those, should be considered exempt and allowed to design their own regulation despite all the evidence of their failure to do so. Yesterday, I said that they lied about all this, and they do. As Harry Evans said in his Cudlip lecture, quote, "The misrepresentation of Leveson's core report is staggering. To portray his careful construct for statutory underpinning as state control is a gross distortion." That's Harry Evans, who is a journalistic giant in a generation of pygmies, his views reported in just one paper, The Guardian, whereas any hack or politician who is opposed to Leveson will get free rein in any paper they want. Let me go through some of the lies. Press freedom is over. That's a lie. Politicians will decide what you read. That's a lie. Investigations into stories like MPs' expenses could not happen. That's a lie. There will be pre-publication censorship. That's a lie. Editors will go to jail if they don't sign up. A lie. This is all about protecting politicians and celebrities. That's a lie. It's about protecting people without power or wealth or fame who can have their lives and have had their lives destroyed by inhumane and illegal journalistic activity. What Leveson proposed and what the Royal Charter now says does not even come close to establishing regulation of the press. It proposes a body to certify that any new self-regulator is independent. That is underpinning. It is not state control. The body would be independent of press so that they cannot control it or water it down, and independent of politicians so that a future government could not randomly make it more draconian. There are many other advantages to what's been proposed and to what the press are resisting. The new body would have investigative powers to deal with papers which keep breaching the code of practice, and an arbitration procedure which will be cheaper for both people and publishers to use rather than going to the law. It will have a new code, but it will retain much of the current editor's code of practice, which promises accuracy and respect for privacy. The PCC editor's code was actually a very, very good piece of work. It has just never been adhered to, never been implemented, and of course that was always the Murdoch-Dacre plan. The Press Complaints Commission has been a body of the press, by the press, for the press. Just ask yourself what those same owners and editors would have to say if any other walk of life had been exposed for so much wrongdoing, given rise to so much public disgust, and then still made the claim that they were capable of a self-regulatory system authored by the likes of Paul Dacre and Guy Black, a Tory peer and one of the succession of press groupies who has run the PCC. They would be insulted, hounded and vilified. The press have thrown every false argument in the book, and still, though this opinion poll got even less coverage than Harry Evans' lecture, more than 7 out of 10 readers want Leveson-style independence for a new regulator. The papers want nothing that gets in the way of business as usual. The good news is that despite their attempts to grind down the politicians, they are not getting their way. The even better news is that when finally this new system happens, none of their big lies will come true. Both press and public will gain. That is why I'm optimistic, despite the publishers trying to ignore the Royal Charter at the moment, hoping their alternative, the independent, brackets, sick, press standards organisation, will be deemed acceptable. It won't, as anyone who has read the Leveson report will see. Indeed, tomorrow, the Media Standards Trust is publishing an external analysis of IPSO, the Independent Press Standards Organisation, and it establishes that of Leveson's 38 recommendations for a self-regulator, only 12 are met by their proposal. It fails on the very first test in the very first word of its misleading title. It is not independent. It is almost entirely dependent on the industry, which influences virtually every aspect of what it does, and in many cases has a veto. Through the proposed funding body, it institutionalises the power of the big publishers, just as its predecessor used its money to grip and control the PCC. It will control budgets, rules, code, investigations, and sanctions for breaches. It is not even independent of politics, because there is a provision for peers and MEPs to be on the regulator. And it's hard to know whether it was Lord Black or Lord Hunt, the latest Tory peer to run the PCC, who wrote that bit. It also fails the central Leveson test, since it does not provide access to justice for ordinary members of the public via low-cost arbitration. And the complaint system is virtually the same as the utterly discredited PCC. Leveson called for a, quote, simple and credible investigations process. Dacre, Black and Hunt have gone for complicated and incredible instead, allowing for up to 6 interventions by the publisher and none by the victim. It makes a total mockery of the claims they made in adverts in their own papers that Ipso, quotes, will deliver all of the key elements Lord Justice Leveson called for in his report. More lies. It leaves me thinking either they are incredibly stupid or they think that everybody else is incredibly stupid. And one thing of which I am absolutely certain, you will read very little about this report in the papers tomorrow. Another planned news blackout because it doesn't support their bogus arguments. They claim, of course, to speak for the public. Hence another news blackout on a recent Transparency International report which showed that British people viewed the media as the most corrupt of 12 institutions surveyed. 69% named it thus, up from 39% 3 years ago. Now, I'm pleased that politicians have thus far held reasonably firm, with a few wobbles, a bit of opportunism from Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, and confused statements by the Culture Secretary, Maria Miller. It's almost a year now since Leveson published his report. It's time to get on with it. Here is what I think will eventually happen, and it's another reason for optimism. Dacre, Black and Company will push their luck. They always do. They will overplay their hand. They always do on Ipso. It will be clear to anyone who can read that it is not Leveson compliant. As politicians, public and the victims of media abuse lose patience, so will sections of the press who are less wrapped up in the lie machine. Some will then set up a self-regulator to meet Royal Charter standards. Other newspapers will join because the costs of staying out, for example, having to pay both sides of a libel case, win or lose, will be so high. The system will settle down, and we will all look back with utter bemusement at their warnings of an end to civilization we know it, and contempt at their continuing machinations. Because still, the lie machine cranks on. Repressive Britain, I read recently. So let's talk about repression. Turkey had 49 journalists in prison last year, followed by Iran on 45, China 32, Eritrea 28, Syria 15, Britain fairly well down the table on zero. There is only one big point put forward with which I have any sympathy at all, and that is the suggestion that countries which do repress the media will say, Britain is doing so, therefore why shouldn't we? But they can only pose the question because of the lies told by our press. And for further evidence of the lies and hypocrisy, go to Ireland, where UK titles have signed up to a similar system without any skin falling from their Pinocchio noses. The threat to journalism comes not from politicians, but from within, from arrogant and overweening industry leaders who love editorials saying, wake up and smell the coffee, but cannot smell it for themselves. cannot see that falling sales are about more than new technology. They're about falling credibility and rising public awareness about their methods and their abuse of power. Once this debate is settled, journalism can start to look at how it rebuilds its reputation. As I said yesterday, it can only be done by the next generation. And this is one of my biggest reasons for optimism. The Murdoch-Dacre generation has had its day. You do not have to have a master's in corporate history to know that the post-Murdoch era will lead to substantial change in his organisation. Politicians who've been so reluctant to tackle standards might then see, as the empire moves and separates in different directions, that the real issue, ducked by successive governments, is ownership. The leadership of this generation of journalism have been Murdoch, the single most powerful figure in the British media, Dacre, who, shorn of the moderating David English and exploiting the weakness of his owner, Lord Rothermere, became a very different animal, the Barclay brothers, to a lesser extent, all of an age and reputation where influence and strength are waning. They cannot see, not least since Leveson, the similarity with union leaders in the Thatcher era, desperately clinging on to power and systems being overtaken by people demanding change. The change is happening and will continue to happen, in part because of public anger, in part because of campaigning by victims and activists, but also because a younger generation is better at reading the rhythms of change. I mentioned Mark Zuckerberg yesterday, age 29. Google's Larry Page is a veteran. He's nearly 40. The owners of Twitter are 30-somethings. Of course, these are exceptional people, but it's exceptional people who become leaders. And it's in those who've made their millions, and more so those of the same age, being driven as much by idealism as by profits, who give me some hope that there will be real change. How remarkable it was to pick up last Friday's Financial Times and read the business life profile of an online magazine editor, Tavi Gevinshin, who's aged 17. It could be, of course, that the new media will simply create new oligarchs, less interested in good journalism, which costs money, than in the financial power the platforms and advertising give them. Let's be very, very wary of billionaire techies thinking that algorithms and other people's blogs are all that you need for good journalism. Let's see how Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, handles the Washington Post, which he's recently bought. Let's see if the sense develops that the Facebook-Twitter revolution is really not about more democratic media, but about the flotation billions. Let's keep an eye on so-called demand media, otherwise known as advertorials, gaining hold as they've started to in the States. And let's be very wary as well of the danger of a new rich-poor divide which further weakens journalism as a pillar of democracy. On the one side, free news in short blasts. On the other, proper journalism reserved for those willing to pay for it. But for now, let's be optimistic and try to ensure that social media becomes a counterweight to oligarchism, not a modern, sexier version. We see the benefits of social media also in the way the press find themselves at the centre of storms they're more used to creating. Jan Moyer of The Mail, when she wrote what many felt to be offensive and homophobic remarks about Stephen Gately. The Guardian, when some felt it overstepped the balance between security and freedom of information. The Daily Mail, with its attack on the father of Ed Miliband. I was very pleased when Paul Dacre was finally forced into print with his rather lame defence, and pleased even more that he felt I was orchestrating the campaign against him. I wasn't, but certainly I was playing a part, seeking to ensure, just for a few days, that he was subject to the sort of scrutiny he expects others in powerful positions to endure every minute of their life. Once upon a time, these newspapers could control the content, the presentation, and the response. Now that they can be challenged more openly, even those who block comments merely find them ventilated more loudly elsewhere. This is changing the relationship between journalism and the public, largely in the public's favour. At the other end of the income scale from Zuckerberg and company, campaigns like Everyday Sexism and No More Page 3 have been interesting additions to the media scene. Page 3's centrality to the success of The Sun reflected cultural winds at the time. But culture changes, and the campaign for its removal uses social and conventional media to engage directly with the paper about its own content, and in so doing is actually part of the journalistic process. The thing to be clear about is that journalism isn't dying. It's just that technological advance means that the print platform is gradually, very gradually, disappearing. But print journalism didn't die when radio came along, it adapted. Radio didn't die when TV came along, it adapted. The web is forcing all forms of media and politics to adapt. More optimism. The new delivery systems can be more democratic, even if at times they seem anarchic, and they offer the opportunity to pioneer a journalism less influenced by corporate interests. Rightly, the media, big media corporations, for their own survival, are doing all that they can to build online audiences for their journalistic content. But previously tame audiences are much harder to corral. Political and business elites will always fight hard for themselves, but there is at least a chance that in the next generation, media ownership and control will be, to coin a new Labour phrase, for the many, not the few. The new technologies empower a growing army of citizen journalists, bloggers, readers and commenters to construct a more pluralistic debate. A monopolistic industrial model of journalism, where the agenda was set by journalist elites, is shifting towards a network model based on profit and non-profit, individual and organised journalistic practice. As the Murdoch-Dacre generation fades away, that is grounds for optimism. But this generation, the generation of students here, has to make it happen. Witness also the way that those who believe in genuine investigative journalism are doing something about it. Because here is another big irony of the modern media. For all the talk of Watergate and thalidomide, the Murdoch-Dacre generation actually no longer really does the journalism that they claim to be defending. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism was born of the fear that media which used to do proper investigations either don't want to or can't afford to do them anymore. So now you have ProPublica in the US, the Knight Foundation, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a network of 160 reporters in 60 countries who collaborate on big investigations. Most recently, a big one on the illegal trade of human tissue, another one on the dangers of the global trading in asbestos. Here we have the Centre for Investigative Journalism, a charity committed to training journalists in in-depth reporting and defence of the public interest. These are important steps, and again, grounds for optimism. Now, before his death, Robin Cook, former Foreign Secretary, used to cite a report which suggested that the positive to negative ratio in our newspapers moved from 3 to 1, 3 positive to 1 negative in 1974, to 1 to 18 in the early 21st century. That reflected the widespread belief that negativity, hysteria, sensation and crisis are all that sell. In fact, I believe the press made a collective strategic error with this approach. The incredible positivity around the time of the London Olympics was a rare example of public mood overwhelming the usual negativity and the desire for failure that runs through the media. The negativity, overblown hype and lack of balance have helped turn people away from the press as a prime source of news. The rise in social networks is in part based on the concept of friends. We don't believe politicians like we used to. We don't believe business like we used to. We don't believe the media. So who do we believe? We believe each other, our friends. The papers think their decline is about technology. I think it's as much about their values and their journalism. Even at the Daily Mirror, a red top, we had a network of foreign correspondents, all gone. Are people becoming less interested in the world? I doubt it, given how much more we travel. Or is it simply that modern journalism cannot afford the investment needed to cover the world, as opposed to those issues it deems newsworthy and which are easy to cover, like what's on telly? Even the big global news agencies like Reuters, AP and AFP today leave vast swathes of the world completely uncovered. Specialist journalism within many mainstream outfits is frankly dying. We had health, defence, education, environment, transport correspondents, all areas of national life covered by someone dedicated to developing expertise and contacts in that area. Without them, why should anybody be surprised that so much copy now comes straight from PR material? And we're not just talking about tabloids. The Columbia Journalism Review established that in one edition of the Wall Street Journal, no less, half of the news stories were based on press releases. The press, they claim reverence for democracy, and they regularly attack the Blair government for, quotes, marginalising Parliament, close quote. The marginalisation of Parliament comes from the utter failure to report it. Jack Straw did an analysis which showed that between the 30s and the 80s, quality newspapers, when Parliament was sitting, ran 800 lines of copy per day on average. By the early 90s, it was down to fewer than 100. When I was political editor on The Mirror, we had two full-time gallery reporters just covering the debates in Parliament. Now, not just The Mirror, but most of the broadsheets have none. Parliamentary coverage is reduced to joke smiths writing sketches and occasional clips from Prime Minister's questions on the television, with the question usually not what was it about, but who won. Now, they would argue that Parliament doesn't sell. In a democracy where the media has an important place at the heart of that democracy, my answer to that is, so what? A dedicated Parliament channel, which few people watch, does not mean that mainstream news should relegate Parliament as it has done. Now, maybe 16 gallery reporters for The Times was overmanning. But these days, you can wander into the public gallery and regularly you will see a lone Hansard reporter recording proceedings. It's the same in local government, where local papers have been hurt by massive cuts in investment in journalism, often while the papers themselves continue to make a profit. It's the same in the courts. There used to be more than 20 reporters working for agencies out of the High Court, now down to a handful. The media currently have a big campaign pushing for to get cameras into the courtrooms. But every day today, there are courts operating without any media coverage at all. What they want is the new, the exciting, the sensational. They're not actually interested in covering what is happening. Those who run the industry have done so as though they were making cars, cakes, or fridges. But journalism is not the same because of its centrality to the democratic process, to the national and international dialogue. Now, a word here about the public. It is not easy for politicians to criticise the public because they want their votes. It's not easy for the media to criticise the public because they want them to consume their products. But I can and I do criticise the public because it is too easy for the public just to blame politicians and the press for the state of affairs that we have. Of course, the media has a responsibility to inform, but the public, in my view, has a responsibility to want to be informed, sufficient to play a role, at least the act of voting. Now, perhaps previous generations had less choice, so almost certainly they had less choice about how they spent their time, much less entertainment, far fewer distractions. But also, I think they had a higher sense that they should try to be informed. People thinking it matters who they vote for in X Factor, but not who they vote for as an MP or Prime Minister, who can't be bothered, in quotes, to find out what the choices are, they are part of the democratic problem that we have, and I think they should be challenged far more. The Reuters Institute did a very interesting piece of work recently using focus groups, which showed that most people did not actually understand the stories they were hearing reported. For example, here in Britain, half a dozen focus groups were shown reports on the primaries leading to Barack Obama's election as Democrat candidate. Every person in every group thought that the primary was the presidential election itself. And in the States, Recently, comedian TV presenter Jimmy Kimmel did an incredible report on Americans passionately saying they preferred the Affordable Care Act over Obamacare, not realizing they are the same thing. Media and politics make massive assumptions about public knowledge. When you go home tonight, Google Jimmy Kimmel Obamacare, watch it, laugh, and then despair. The negativity, disinterest, and apathy call for politics to do a far better job of defending itself. It also requires more political education from a positive standpoint. Just as we teach children that sport is good for them, we should teach them that politics at its best is a good thing and public service something they should aspire to rather than sneer at. We should, in my view, lower the voting age, and alongside it we should introduce compulsory voting with a none of the above option in local and national elections. Russell Brand's performance with Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight recently was electrifying TV, but it was dangerous. People should get involved, people should vote, and they should get into politics in whatever way they can to make a difference. So, journalism matters. It always will. Politicians will always need to be wary of it. But the fact that media brands have less control is a good thing, and the fact that politicians can't control the agenda as they could, even in my time, is no bad thing either. I'm very often asked, and in fact, given there are students in the room, I will preempt the question, was Malcolm Tucker based on me? To which I say, what, a sweary Scottish spin doctor trying to maintain strategic cohesion among ministers and set the government agenda across the media? Fuck yeah. But the new media landscape and its relentless pressures actually mean that politicians should focus more on strategy and less on the day-to-day. Angela Merkel is technically not a great communicator, if you judge it against Clinton's charisma, Obama's rhetoric, Blair's delivery of a message, or the drama of Margaret Thatcher. But say the name Angela Merkel, and you know who or what she is, even though most of you don't understand what she's saying, because you don't speak German. That is effective strategic communication over time. Too many respond to the chaotic new media landscape by being tactical. The right approach is to focus ever more sharply on strategy to make the weather rather than just respond to the squalls. Since researching these speeches and trying to say something I didn't say in my two very, 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 very long submissions to Leveson, I've perhaps surprised myself in wanting to speak up for journalism, despite despising much that the Murdoch-Dacre generation has done to our culture. Democracy needs good journalism. None of us should want a journalism that is underinvested, lacking in proper standards, not counting. Nobody benefits from the phrase, you can't believe what you read in the papers, moving from something that people say to something that's actually true. Journalism, defined so much recently by its own scandals, celebritisation, at times a moral depravity in which all that matters is the story, true or false, no matter how it's got, has to regain its place as a recognised, respected source of inquiry, a mechanism of accountability, a watchdog for protecting the public interest. It will take time, but I do think that provided a new generation comes through that does have moral codes, does have respect for other people and for learning, does understand the wrong turn that this fading generation took, then it can happen. Princeton professor Paul Starr, if I may quote a Princeton professor at Cambridge, gave this argument for journalism. He said, "One danger of reduced news coverage is to the integrity of government. News coverage is not the only thing that newspapers have given us. They have lent the public a powerful means of leverage over the state, and this leverage is now at risk. Newspapers have helped to control corrupt tendencies in both government and business. If we are to avoid a new era of corruption, we're going to have to summon that power in other ways. Our new technologies do not retire old responsibilities." And for all the bad in journalism, I find myself agreeing with that. Which brings me, finally, to WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden. Now, I know people in very senior positions who argue convincingly that both these mass dumpings of important, often secret information have done fundamental damage to our and to others' security and interests. Journalists argue that they've handled them sensitively, they've been mindful of the risks. Security people say they cannot possibly know. The former journalist in me would like to side with the papers. The former government spokesman in me sides with the security services and the politicians. The experience of both in me says there have to be mechanisms and relationships and the capacity for serious, meaningful dialogue to agree a framework of rules and to discuss specific issues as they arise. None of this is easy. Snowden produced much that the public should know, as did WikiLeaks. But the effect was to put journalists in the position of deciding what should and shouldn't be secret, with surely no full knowledge of what could be harmful or even deadly. These two positions, one, we should know what's done in our name, or two, publication could kill agents, harm methods, even cause a terrorist massacre, cannot be dissolved by one side asserting that it must be got out because it's an outrage if it doesn't, or a blanket condemnation of anything coming out on the other side. This is one of the biggest questions facing contemporary journalism. Most journalism of any depth depends on leaks. Somebody in a position of authority who tells a journalist what's going on behind closed doors. This can be an authorised leak, which is common, or an unauthorised leak, which stems from a variety of motives, one of which might be and often is disagreement with something happening within a given organisation and a desire to disclose as a way of bringing about change. Ironically, the film Fifth Estate is based on leaks from within WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks opened up huge questions of responsibility. What is being released? How? Who is affected? What are the consequences? Does the release of the information contravene norms, values, and the law? Has all this affected diplomacy? If a country is fearful of secret views and facts being tapped and published, are they prepared to disclose important information to their allies? Is a long-term consequence that there would be less, not more, transparency because of resulting changes in diplomacy? On the other hand, does WikiLeaks not conform to, quotes, everyone's right to freedom of opinion and expression, which includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontier, as championed in the First Amendment of the American Constitution, Article 5 of the German Basic Law, or Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? These are really big questions, with two strongly contrasting views dominating the debate. That of the revealers, that the care taken to redact compromising material leaves the presentation of the rest entirely in the public interest, and that of the governments and security services, that the journalist cannot possibly know what to redact, and it's in the public interest anyway, for security reasons, to be able to keep secrets. It's clearly, in my view, in our interest to know how much investigation is encroaching on our personal communication and information, and indeed on that of politicians such as Angela Merkel and Dilma Rousseff. Though personally, I feel more uncomfortable about how much the new media corporations know about us and constantly try to sell us based on our digital footprint. It's clearly in our interest to have security services who keep us secure. But one thing I do know, the self-same people who attack the security services for gathering information will be the first to ask why didn't they know when somebody gets through the cracks and blows up a bus. What Glenn Greenwald, The Guardian, The New York Times and others have been close to saying is that journalists are as, if not more, able to decide on public interest and safety than the state and its security. That is a vast claim which I believe cannot be made with confidence. WikiLeaks is a source. Snowden is a source. The fact that he is a source with a treasure trove of damaging, sensational, secret information with legitimate questions, by the way, to be asked about why he had access to it all, does not make him God, even for the Guardian. It makes him a source. Less deep throat than deep technology, but a source. Editors then have to decide what to do with the source material. And that's best done in a journalism framed not by algorithms and blogs, but by an agreed regulatory framework, moral codes of behaviour, and mature dialogue. And as the post-Leveson press make their ludicrous claims that we're going to resemble China or Iran, ask yourself this. Would a Snowden-type story even see the light of day there? And here is where the press should be optimistic, because political, cultural, and technological trends are all towards openness and transparency. When I was a journalist, I went into briefings in Downing Street and asked the question of the person whose job I would one day do, we never comment on intelligence was the standard line of anything to do with MI5, MI6, or GCHQ. Spy chiefs could not even be named. Now they appear live on television being quizzed by MPs. The Spycatcher saga, which some of you may remember, in which the state prevented publication of a book, is utterly unimaginable today. One or two Tory MPs have called on The Guardian to be prosecuted over Snowden. Meanwhile, President Obama, a little bit more powerful, rings his colleagues to apologise and calls for a debate on the balance between privacy and public interest, between secrecy and disclosure. It will never, ever be a perfect relationship between state and media, and nor should it. But here's why I do see grounds for optimism. Because people are more media savvy and they are fed up with what they're being served up, and that is driving change. Because there will be a new and better system of regulation serving the public rather than press and politics. Because the Murdoch-Dacre generation is fading out, and new media and a new generation of people are eroding their power and influence and democratising our media. Because the trends are towards openness and transparency. Because painfully, politics and journalism are adapting to a new age, and because politicians can now afford to be more strategic. The force of the media age, and above all the deadline-destroying 24-hour news channels and the border-destroying internet, have brought changes which are difficult for both old government and old media. Both will adapt best if there is clear understanding of the different jobs they do and mutual respect for that difference. This is what was eroded when spin became a catch-all term of abuse for all communication. It's time that a bit of mutual respect and understanding of different responsibilities returned. The press, seeing that the proposed new system of regulation is not the menace they claim, and recognising that amid the threats of technological change have been massive opportunities, that would be a good start to the process. And politicians, being more not less strategic, less not more tactical, focused on long-term challenges and big issues, ignoring the day-to-day noise, would improve public debate more quickly than they might imagine. I've droned on long enough. I don't know how long we've got for questions, but I'm happy to take them about that and indeed anything else. Thank you very much indeed.